Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Robert Colville, editor of CapEx, and today I'll be talking to Frank Field. Frank is the man charged by Tony Blair with thinking the unthinkable on welfare, who was then promptly sacked for thinking it. He was one of the first mainstream politicians to warn about the dangers of mass immigration, and one of the few on the Labour benches to campaign for Brexit. In his role as chairman of the Work and Pensions Select Committee, he also played a leading role in hounding Sir Philip Green over BHS. We'll be talking about the collapse of the Labour Party, the power of faith in politics, and how Frank accidentally abolished modern slavery.
I mean, I'd grown up in a working class Tory household, and I'd grown out of it. And this was, you know, an issue where that became the parting of the way. So it wasn't, I didn't have any Pauline conversions. I didn't sort of fall about with blinding lights being shone at me and all the rest of it. I mean, it was a natural move to make.
But you were always interested in politics. You, yes. You were always sort of drawn to it.
Yes, I mean, I was then much more optimistic about change than I am now. When I look back to then, I thought, great thing about being in politics, the change you could actually help bring about. I'm more cautious now, but always optimistic.
So I suppose the great thing is the change you can prevent from happening, possibly.
Sometimes that, but I'm half full glass rather than half empty.
So did you then go straight over to Labour, or was there a...
Yes, I did. Now I joined... shortly afterwards. Yes, I was a working class Tory family. That's why I understand the Labour vote so well, or a large part of it. And one can make it sound grand or grander than it is, but I helped organise a boycott of South African goods in Brentford and Chiswick, where I was secretary of the Young Tories with a school friend who was secretary of the Young Labour. And what it really amounted to, we printed some leaflets to hand out. But I was squeezed out the Tory party. I'm quite pleased to be squeezed out. And it was just before Macmillan's Winds of Change speech, that great speech saying what's sweeping through Africa. And before that, the Young Tories were holding the old line on race. And then many of them, once Macmillan had made that move and given that speech, changed their views. But I'd left by then. But it did show the importance of leadership, that speech of Macmillan's on the Winds of Change changed a generation of young Tories' views about race.
But obviously, I mean, apartheid was and race in Africa were still still one of the dividing lines in politics for years after that.
It was, but he'd actually managed to stake out for younger radical members who previously had loyally kept the Tory line that they could break loose, really.
But one of the sort of interesting things about you is that you aren't a politician who takes the party line. I mean, I know there have been various attempts over the years by the Tories to bring you back into the fold.
No, I didn't last night, on our first night, committee stage of the Brexit bill. I won't today, and nor am I tomorrow on our last day on the Brexit bill. So I'd be voting against the party line and all of them.
You sort of came to prominence for most people, I guess, in 97 under Blair, when you're the guy who's famously appointed to think the unthinkable.
There was occasion before when I was I'd joined Sharp of the Action Group, and it had made some really good advances, but it was fairly moribund's the wrong word, isn't it? But it there was a great debate whether they should just roll up and become part of Shelter. And some of the executives thought no and appointed me. And that led to me writing a memorandum of what had happened to the poor under Labour, which I headed, knowing that that would get the story off the ground. The poor become poor under Labour. It was a long time after that before public meetings people wouldn't shout Judas at me, because party loyalty is much stronger then than it is now. And then of course there was the Blair era as well, of giving me a title but not meaning any of it.
I mean that sort of feels like in a way the sort of the golden thread of your career, this sort of concern for the poor, both in Britain and overseas, but a sort of a recognition that the market is often the way to do that.
There is that, and also the other case is that I'm viewed as an outsider, but I long to be an insider. But just so happens that the events one's dealing with pushes me to the outside to say what I think should be said, and to organise in a way that I think one should organise, and often try to defeat the government, whether it's a Tory government or a Labour government.
Where did those ideas come from? You're a very religious man. You're on the Synod of the Church of England, I think.
No, I got deselected there.
Oh, what happened?
In that, quite some time ago, there was the issue about women priests, and it seemed to me just bizarre not to have women priests. In that there was a lack of male priests and a large number of women who wanted to be priests. And Christians believe that God speaks in different ways to people. And in the Old Testament, he was set like to bushes to draw attention. It just seemed that this was another way of the Spirit speaking to the church. What are you going on about? And the Catholic group on the synod, which I was part of, I'd been nominated as a co-opted member by Runcie, then turned on me, decided they were going to block any further extension. So I have a habit of getting deselected. But it was over women priests.
But you also have a habit then of being sort of weirdly ahead of your party. So, you were ahead of the Tories way back when. You were on apartheid. You were ahead of Labour on welfare. And then you were ahead of pretty much everyone on immigration.
Yes, there's no prizes for that, because people don't want to afterwards to... I mean, it's quite amazing now, isn't it, the numbers of people who say they've changed their views in the Labour Party on immigration because of the vote in their constituencies on Brexit. But have they changed, really changed, is my question. I mean, it's great if they have. But yes.
There's quite a lot of meetings at which you hear a Labour MP say, of course we get the message, of course we're listening on immigration, and the thing to do is have lots of conversations which help people understand that it's not a problem.
I'm sure some of them have got the message, and many more will when they face the electorate and a UKIP candidate that actually really is asking them where do they stand on these matters.
I mean, do you think that you and Nicola Soames, which is one of the oddest couples in recent political history, set up the group on balanced migration.
We now more look alike, don't we, given his wonderful, successful weight-losing efforts. No, but again, it's, that if we could have Nicholas working on this issue, and he obviously thought if he could have me working on it as well, then for both sides, both parties, it's unexpected, isn't it?
And that was sort of back in the days when the Blair government had very successfully rendered talking about immigration beyond the political pale.
Yes, yeah. And the truth is, of course, I wasn't brave enough to raise it as an issue, that I thought it was an issue for yonks, until we were talking about white people coming in. I mean, even then, the anger that this is was racist was one had to face. And David Blunkett and Jack Straw both made statements, went on the media to say that, that we assure you that Frank isn't racist. And I remember one conversation with David, who kindly said, look, I can assure you Frank isn't racist. And I said, David, how do you know I'm not racist? How do you know in my heart what I really think, even if I know myself on that? Isn't it the argument we have to face, not the category that somebody might talk about this could be a racist? But it was immensely kind of both of them to give me cover, to assure people that there was an argument here that had to be faced. But it still hasn't been faced in the Labour ranks, although people say that it is being. And as you say, that, I mean, people have got a line now to say, but whether anything follows from that, we'll see.
But do you think if people had listened to you and Nicholas Soames earlier on, that, you know, that Brexit wouldn't have happened, or is the sort of, is the die cast as soon as you let in the Eastern Europe, the new entries from Eastern Europe?
Certainly, when they were allowed in without any transition program, we were just, one knew that we were in mega trouble. But then the other trouble was, of course, that we couldn't get Alan Johnson to stand either against Gordon Brown, and we couldn't get Alan Johnson to stand against Ed Miliband. On any occasion, if we could have got Alan in 8 weeks before the election, the first election with 210, we would have won it. And Alan accepts that now, but it hasn't changed his view about standing as leader.
Because he, like you, is someone who speaks to the Labour working classes.
Oh, he's just a wonderful person, isn't he? And got such an extraordinary story that people think this is a real person. And people make a distinction between real people and politicians. And Alan is viewed as a real person, not a politician. I think he all the time is Alan's talking to the country, even if it's a party audience, which I think is important. I mean, there are lessons, of course, for the party, what he's saying, but he's forever thinking about how you deliver success, and that's what we should be here for.
But you were one of the fools, idiots, whatever they've been called, who nominated Jeremy Corbyn in order to have the arguments out in the open, and then saw that backfire rather spectacularly.
No, I'm as guilty as anybody. If that's the point, really, when Labour Party is destroyed, my only defence is, and it's quite a strong one, is that when these proposals, the membership proposals put forward by Ed Miliband for £3, nobody on the NEC saw this danger. And amongst the hard left group, amongst Jeremy, amongst John McDonnell, Diane Abbott, when they were picking their candidate for this, for that fight, and we now know John has gone on record saying this, that they went round the room and people said, "What about you, John?" And he said, No, I've done my bit, I'm not doing it again. I've had a heart attack, Diane Abbott, now I've done mine. And the people then said, "Jeremy, you've not done it, it's your turn." Now, the idea that either John or Diane would have given way if they thought that this was winnable. So we all shared the error. But I, as much as anybody else, by nominating, thinking we'd get a debate, to try and keep the Labour Party comprehensive. But we need that from the right as well as the left. And of course, that's not how it's turned out.
And now Brexit is pulling the party apart even further.
Well, it needn't do, but it certainly is, yes. I mean, the Labour voters have spoken, haven't they? And we'll see from the Stoke by-election whether they are now on the march or not. I don't want to be accused of losing another seat.
You were accused of losing one before?
Oh, I'm endlessly, not what I've actually said, but losing elections, losing seats, God knows what, from what I say. But I mean, the danger is that we're to a huge number of people here, that the Labour vote is now ready to move to a UKIP party that appeals to their national interest. I mean, we had a debate, almost one of our last debates in the parliamentary party before Ed Miliband led us to defeat. And I was told, you know, this is, you know, put up or shut up. So I went to this debate, and a large number of then Labour MPs got up and said, "This, you're the most brilliant. It's a most brilliant speech. Brilliant, 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 brilliant." And I just got up towards the end and said, "Do you actually think that we are responsible for this huge influx? Do you actually think this has actually resulted in real pressure on NHS, that you can't get your children into local schools? There's almost no chance of getting a house. Do you not see any link between our policies of opening the door?" And they'd got up and said no. And the PLP, a lot of them, cheered. And I thought, you know, God, what am I doing in this party? I'd never been so distraught before. And I sat down there as the party filed out this mega committee room, and a small group of peers came up and said, "Frank, we've never been elected, but we understand what you're talking about." And I had said, in more gently than probably I remember, of a group of people barracking me, and I did say something about whether it'd be interesting whether you're back after the election. Well, half of them weren't. I mean, UKIP gave their seats to the Tories.
And I mean, were you ever tempted to just say sod it and go?
No,
and go off
but even if I'm not being, but even if I was, where would you go? I mean, if you were ambitious for office, one would go to the Tories. But I mean, I'm not a Tory, so what do I want to go there for? But the centre left, where is there for anybody? I mean, you've got to be very young now, haven't you, and very ambitious to join any of the existing centre left groups. To think you might be able to exercise power.
Well, I always thought this was the thing about student politics, that everyone seemed to join the party which was then in power. And I always thought that the thing you should do would be to join the party which wasn't in power, because, you know, in 20 years' time, it was likely to, you know, so all of the, when I was at university, all the plausible young people were joining the Labour Party, and, you know, none of them have got seats now. And,
yeah.
But you sense that you know.
No, I agree, yeah.
But you sense that, you know, the Labour, if you do that this time, the Labour Party might not be there.
No, sure. And that's the problem. Since Freud, it's very difficult to know oneself fully, isn't it? So I'm deeply ambitious about achieving goals. And it would have been nice to have had a life which allowed one to be more of the person making the decisions than trying to convince secretaries of state this is what they might do, and it, all sorts of reasons why they should do it. It takes quite a lot of time to do it that way.
And I mean, how are you finding it now on with the committee? I mean, do you find that's a nice sort of pulpit, or is it more a case of sort of shepherd? You know, are you actually able to put your own view forward, or is it about
the consensus? No, it's a collective effort on the committee. We decide the committee as a whole decides its area of work. I rarely come in on questions because I shall give them out to other people and so on. That is in contrast to how some committees are run. I gather people are hardly allowed to speak.
But there does seem to have been a sort of a resurgence of the committee system in the last.
Yeah, no, indeed. And with BHS, which is a long way to go yet, and doing a joint committee with the Biz Committee and joint approach with the Biz Committee, and then how we follow that up with the Prime Minister. No, there's a lot to play for. No, I'm that it's very interesting where in the British Constitution, when the opposition fails, it's very interesting where the opposition reappears. And under Thatcher, it reappeared as the Church of England fighting it. It may well be in the committee system this time. It will certainly be amongst many of the Tories later on if we continue like this. That there will be a natural counterbalance from somewhere.
Because I mean, at the moment, it feels like the pressure is on her is from the right, politically speaking, especially over Brexit. That's where they fear the rebellion can lose them.
Yes, I think she doesn't have to worry about the right at all. Because where does the Tory right go? I mean, this is the best Prime Minister they have got. To get Brexit through. I genuinely believe she wants to deliver Brexit. It's how you do. And either you do it very simply by saying, you know, what terms you're going to offer us initially, and if it's hopeless, just saying, well, bye-bye, we'll do world trade. But we're not going to spend 2 years being absolutely bogged down having these negotiations with you. Are we going to have serious negotiations with you on it? And you've got to actually come up with something quickly.
I mean, what would your preferred model be?
Well, I think it's so complicated. It'd be easier to do the simple break one. At least challenge them on that.
There's a sort of vision of that kind of Brexit, which then also involves, which I'm personally quite attracted to, the sort of smaller state stripping away, you know, trying to make ourselves leaner and more nimble and more competitive. But presumably, that's not quite as attractive to you.
No, I certainly see it as making ourselves more competitive is important, and that this difficult term productivity is key to lots of things, including rising living standards. But I mean, it's very interesting how the view of the state has changed in my lifetime, from one which was seen as a protective organisation to one which is back to as it was originally, as the labour movement started to grow and the trade union movement grew, as an enemy. I mean, that people don't now think, I mean, I don't think many people in Stoke think the state is the solution to their problems, when clearly it has a role to play. The undermining of politicians is quite serious, but then we make it easy for them, don't we, in some of the things that we do, to confirm that view. But I think genuinely about, if you look at the late 1890s and so on, with the beginnings of new unionism, and you've already got the skilled unions, and then the beginnings of the formation of the Labour Party, the Labour movement was anti-state. It saw this, and that's why Gladstone was so successful, as the body that protected the rich. And we're back to the state protecting the rich. I mean, we've not had one banker in the box, let alone sent to prison for all the terrible things that they've inflicted upon us. And I think people do see that as is part of the great drama that's unfolding. They see the state as protecting the very rich and not on their side. And that's a mega change.
But this is the weird thing, isn't it? Trump, for example, campaigns against Wall Street. I crunched through every word he says on Twitter, and you know, Wall Street and bankers and Goldman Sachs were kind of right up there, and he wasn't being nice about them. But
he
then, as the
gave a Goldman Sachs man a job, didn't
yeah,
he?
The instant he gets into office, suddenly it's all about repealing Dodd-Frank and employing Goldman Sachs.
But generally, it's not with him. I mean, he's actually, I would have thought, trying to make a difference, however appallingly or well you think he's doing so. But I mean, I always thought he would win the nomination and the prize itself. I was saying what I thought would happen, not what I thought what wished to happen.
So, I mean, do you think that could happen in Britain as well? I mean, do you think Brexit is as far as we go towards the sort of screw the world impulse? Or is there a... If the May government doesn't succeed...
We have no one in the House of Commons with George Galloway's ability to speak. Whatever you think about his views, Galloway, I'm wonderful. And while when he was speaking in the House of Commons, to be the only person that would stand up and defend Saddam Hussein. There might have been good reasons why he was, what the arrangements were, but it's powerful stuff.
I mean, are there moments that you, sort of looking back, you think that of when you've done that on the floor of the House? I mean, that you can look back and think that yes, I'm proud I did that, or I'm ashamed I didn't.
No, I think I'm typecast, so I couldn't play that sort of role. I remember quite early on with being pushed into the Commons to keep a debate going, and the lovely Jarry member, who was deputy for it, saying speak. I didn't know what the debate was about. It was quite early on in my career, but I've been typecast, and Speaker Weatherall was in the chair. So before I could find out what the debate was about, he called me, not knowing what the hell. This was before we had the big indicators up in the House of Commons. So I just said, would somebody intervene so I could find out what this debate is about? So then somebody intervened, so I could then ask a person, what is this debate on that I've got to speak about? And I then resumed. I had that weekend read one of the companion, looking at the companion volumes for Churchill's Great Life, or The Great Life on Churchill, and there was an occasion when a group of house guests at Chartwell were going down to the summer house, and Churchill was rehearsing a speech saying, "Mr. Speaker, I didn't expect to catch your eye today, i.e. to speak." And they were learning it off by heart. And I said to Weatherall, "Mr. Speaker, I didn't expect to catch your eye. You know, I've been pushed in to speak." And not anybody laughed. This was just straight stuff. Whereas if Neil Kinnock had said it, they'd have been rolling around. I mean, Neil says that about that. You know, he only has to get up and people know that it's going to be a lot of
fun. Or William Hague.
Yes, absolutely. But I can't, you know, no one would take me in that role. When I was first deselected from my constituency as opposed to other places, I mean, the Sunday Times did a poll in Birkenhead about my standing, and it was so good that Andy Grice changed the figures down because he thought it was not believable. And then when they Blair did a poll for in Wirral for the by-election Wirral South just before the end of the before he won in 97, and again that showed. But but who knows what one's standing is here and everywhere.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
But I think the polls are quite good, really.
So how do you... That was something I was going to ask you about. How do you sort of view your relationship with your constituents and how do they sort of inform your thinking?
They teach me all the time. But if anybody says to me, do I represent my constituents, I have no idea how to. I mean, the thought with so many different views and shades of views that I can somehow do that. I'd never do anything else. I'd never get on top of it anyway, what their views are. I just think the role is, which I think they accept, is that I should just come in to say what I think is important to say.
So it's not as if your views on urban poverty derive from a sort of an in-depth study of the Birkenhead.
But they do teach one. So much about what's going on, what it's really like, pulls you up sharp. So as I say, for me it's been a most brilliant 37 years of seminar, constant seminar. That's what I get from my constituency going round. I've always thought I should give up when two things happen. Whether I have the courage is another matter. One is I arrive at Lime Street and I'm not excited. There's always a buzz at Lime Street arriving. And secondly, that when I'm in the constituency, I haven't learnt anything. I normally learn so much I have to forget most of it. I couldn't possibly capitalise on it. I mean, to have a seat, a single member seat, where you're responsible is a great strength of our system. It provides members, if they wish to learn from it, the most marvellous tutorial basis possible.
Do you think the test of temptation, though, that MPs become sort of glorified social workers, that you're so busy attending to your constituents that you don't have the time to think about bigger issues?
There is, and there's obviously a balance to be gained. I remember when I was young socialist, asking Frank Tomley, the member for Hammersmith North, who, you know, for awful views, I thought, how could this man possibly be an MP? And I said, how do you do your job and your correspondence? And he said, I always throw letters away first time, and I answer them if it's important. I said, how do you know it's important? Oh, because they write a second time and say, I've written to you, you haven't answered the letter. And I thought, this is amazing. But he did that by himself, he didn't have a secretary. So then the post bag was tiny compared with what happens now for MPs.
Because email and Twitter, there's more and more channels to reach you.
And email is a huge changer because people just expect you should reply immediately. There's the immediacy of politics rather than you might have thought about something before you gave off a reply. Mrs. T used to, in those days, she had 25 letters in any week on a topic, she was briefed for Prime Minister's questions, because if she'd got 25 letters, the chances were somebody would raise that in the House of Commons. And I think it's quite interesting what campaigns come in via emails.
And are there issues where you sort of find yourself just sort of not so much disagreeing as just ignoring what that the feeling in your inbox or
oh no, I'm on the street. But no, I wasn't that like to actually tell them what I think. I don't think that does you any harm. I do remember once in the first election where it was touch and go. I mean, it was a northern. It was a winter of discontent. I had no idea what it was like canvassing in the north as compared with the south, or how good the difference it really was. And this guy came up with this. He was only typical Labour, lovely stereotyped image with a vest on, and started shouting the most obscene stuff to me on race. And I said, you must never, ever, 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 ever. If I lose my temper, I do lose my temper. And I went, got really excited, and you could see I was very excited. Have you got that? Never, ever, ever. Have you got it? Mm, boom, boom, boom. And he said, what right have you to say who I should vote for? And I knew perfectly well I'd got his vote. So I've always told people, and it's never been very many, just to stuff their vote. Couldn't care tuppence. I just disagree with them.
Presumably this is one of the sort of big issues. Apart from Brexit, obviously, and all it entails, what are the sort of issues which you think, in the way that there was immigration and poverty and racism, what are the sort of issues which you would be campaigning on now for the next 20 years?
One is actually the re-emergence of destitution and hunger. I mean, that's the idea of when one set out that was going to be an issue, that people would actually be hungry, and that given how much richer we are, and still the bottom's fallen out for the bottom. We've got campaigns going on, Feeding Britain, Feeding Birkenhead, an extraordinary sort of response to that. But the media is not that interested in hungry people, which is amazing. Occasionally they'll do something. That's what the lessons we draw from Sir Philip Green and what he's done with BHS for pensions is immensely important. They're longing for it to be seen. I could have asked, wouldn't necessarily have got the judge to make it a jury case. So then, but I'm still waiting.
Although where you'd find with 12 honest men and true who haven't heard of Philip Green.
I know. Well, that would be so, wouldn't it? But there must be some people, mustn't they? I haven't got a view about it. And we'd just go on for days picking the jury, wouldn't we? That may be true, the judge may not give it on those grounds, but I was longing for it because we would see then who was actually being tried. Well, I just think it's just so grotesque what he's done.
I suggested to your colleague Chuck O'Rimmer that the next Labour Prime Minister is more likely to look like Nigel Farage than Tony Blair, and got a very stern response.
Well, I bet you did there.
but I still think it's a...
I think you're dead right. Oh, the idea that we're going to have another Blair, that's impossible. Unless we're totally suicidal. Which is... Though it's going to be a Jess Phillips figure, isn't it? It's not going to be a charmer like Blair. If we're going to survive, somebody who's straight talking, who just mixes it and goes in there. You're absolutely right on that.
I suppose the survival of the Labour Party is a weird thing to find yourself sort of worrying about and focusing on after so many years within it.
And partly it's that if you just look at the Republican Party before Reagan, people thought it would never get elected again, got it elected. Everybody this time said it's all hopeless, it's sewn up for Hillary, and I don't know whether he is a Republican or not, but somebody who carries that label actually gets elected. So it's quite strange what happens. But it just is that if you look at Jeremy's views, he is nothing but consistent and honest about them. And they are views which the core, that very important white working class vote, simply do not share. and he's not prepared to move, and they're not prepared to move. That's the danger we have, in somehow, if we only can stay in this long enough, the wheel would come round and we'll get washed into Downing Street. That's not an option at the moment.
I suppose this is a wider question about politics. Do you think it's more important to sort of get the leader right or get the ideas right? I mean, is it about having the sort of the figure who, you know, the figure at the top, or is it about the people at the bottom?
Oh, I think it's the leader. I'm an old elitist in this sense, but I think the form of elitism has fundamentally changed. Hence, what sort of person needs to be the next Labour leader if we're going to win. And it's not going to be a Blairite or a Blair-type creature. But so from those early days when one saw the role that Macmillan made by leadership convinced me. And then Gaitskell, I mean, that was the real person that attracted me into the Labour Party. Those wonderful speeches when he, on the Tories introduced the first immigration bill, and he fought it, was going to run principle against it, particularly as it affected the Commonwealth. And all the senior people said, for goodness sake, Hugh, do not touch this issue, you know, it's dangerous and all that. And before the second reading, the polls show he's got a majority against the bill. So leadership, I think, is immensely important. The public are up for leadership. They're not up for those who dissemble, certainly not now. I think you've got to do two things. One is we need Jeremy, a figure like Jeremy, with his character and sincerity and so on, but with the right views to do this. And then secondly, that the life that he or she leads has got to be one that also can win middle class votes. That's our coalition. We cannot win without that coalition. Redemption is not just in the old working class vote. It's just that's what we brought into existence to protect. And to lose that and to think there's enough votes in the North London elite is folly beyond belief. But we do need middle class votes as well.
Especially because Scotland is now lost, probably.
Forever. It's about time you had a woman leader. But you know, the guy from Norwich.
That's Clive Lewis.
Clive Lewis, sorry, I should be quick on that. He's got that. He's authentic. I mean, I would favour a woman. I mean, it just seems to me to be appalling to have had two women prime ministers in the Tory party. I mean, we haven't really. I mean, I know temporarily and all sorts of things, but we haven't actually had a woman leader in the Labour Party and taking us into government. But needs must. Maybe, you know, it will be Clive and his attractiveness. I mean, it's a tough cookie. I mean, from coming in here and being on the front bench straight away and taking those responsibilities, it's been and the furnace has tested him.
And who do you rate on the Tory side, from the Prime Minister down?
The great thing about the Tory party is that, I mean, they do have the best Prime Minister they could have. So I can't really think about who is coming up, because normally Prime Ministers are very bad about bringing on the next generation. I mean, I'm not the Cabinet. There are always people in the Cabinet who might want to get your job. But I mean, it's the generation earlier than that one ought to be looking at. And the Prime Minister making sure that there's plenty of time for those people to shine. Attlee used to come in and sit for hours listening to the debate, because he never believed what the whip said about members. So he would get a feel of who was hopeless and who was promising. And he started out, of course, thinking that an Ireland Bevan would be his successor, and then was disappointed by an Ireland's behaviour over a number of matters.
Did you ever, in your early years, think that that would be your career path?
Never thought that. I promise you, I never thought that. I mean, I'd like to have had a period in government to see whether
you had a period in government.
I know, but it. But my naivety was that I somehow thought it was a genuine offer, and not the presentation offer for a Labour victory. Blair once said to me, "You reach people that even I can't reach," And I ought to have registered that and said, oh, that's really why they want me on board. That this is not going to be serious at all. But I made a mistake about him. I thought he was would stand up to Gordon. And we had sessions in the cabinet, on the welfare cabinet committee, where the rest of the cabinet would be silent and I'd be fighting him, Gordon. And yet he didn't think it was important to keep me there for his own good, never mind about the programme. So it was an extraordinary puzzle for me that Blair could get the crown, had all those abilities to get the crown, and yet I think so unsuited to be Prime Minister. All the dirty work he asked other people to do. Contrast that with Mr. Attlee, just did his own dirty work, just sacked people, just said, you're not up to it. And up you go. I mean, the whole thing was different. The idea that you'd get colleagues to spin and talk about your colleagues. I mean, appalling state of affairs.
I mean, the story I always like is at the start of his second term, he calls in the sort of reforming ministers, you know, the Byers, Milburn, you know, he said, like, you guys are in charge of health, education, transport. This is going to be the term we really get the changes. And within 3 years, I think it is, Gordon Brown has got rid of all of them. Or they've got rid of themselves.
The surprise to lots of people was that Gordon didn't have any ideas when push came to shove. Tony didn't really. And he was endlessly trying to grab something which, you know, could be a good story in the Mail or in the Sunday Times. I don't think he ever had a clear... My conversations with him before, I never thought this man's got a vision programme, what he actually wants to... Or nor did the party give him one to actually implement.
And do you think the same is true of Cameron and May?
I think certainly with Cameron that's true. I mean, but being a Tory and just wanting to govern isn't an improper thing to do. It's not a proper thing for the improper thing for the Labour Party to want to do. I mean, and Mrs. May, who I would doubt whether she had a programme before, is having one forced on her. So.
And the question, the sort of ultimate question I wanted to ask you in the sort of classic thing that a writer always gets asked is, you know, where do you get your ideas? What is it? You know, why do you think the things you think about public policy, about the best ways to make people better off?
I can't tell you. It's quite interesting how, you know, they occur. Oh, they seem so obvious to me. Sometimes, ones that come up, and I then forget the actual very basis of them, the actual event which made me think about those. I mean, I do know, I mean, one thing which maybe is more important, partly because of my views, Patrick, who had Andrew's job before, was always conscious I was a sort of fascist figure and all my image needed remodelling. And this report, wonderful report from Ian Duncan Smith's group came up.
The CSJ.
And it was on slavery, and Patrick said, it's in the diary. And I said, Patrick, I know nothing, I'm not interested at all. He said, you're going. So I went to go. I went. And I sat there, and this is disputed by the editor of The Spectator. He spoke for too long, and for once in his life was boring. And then there were other speakers, and I thought, what can I say in 30 seconds? And I said in 30 seconds, one is that we must call trafficking by its real name slavery, and we must have a bill. And I spent the summer with Tim, who worked in the office then, of trying to get Fiona Hill to persuade the Home Secretary that was, you know, it's a really important issue, but an important issue for her image as well. And we got the bill. Now, normally lots of ideas take 30 years to get across. That was sort of 3 months of lobbying. But that resulted in me being pushed into something I didn't want to do. And then I thought, oh God, we need an act, so let's go for it. So that's how it occurred then. But it wasn't a noble thing. There was somebody trying to quite nicely protect my, you know, remodel the image a bit by giving me a sort of softer contours to it. But it resulted in a great piece of legislation, and the Prime Minister says it's the most important thing that she's industry's most proud of, which is terrific to have a prime minister.
And you came up with it in 30 seconds.
Yeah, because I was bored and my bones...
and Fraser Nelson had talked too long.
And my bones were aching. And I thought, what about this 300 people? Because CSJ are brilliant at launching things. They may just made an error this time. But they got the whole of the library, the National Liberal Club, full of people who wanted to get out. This has gone on far too long. And then I learnt so much more about how it... the genesis of it, and that Wilberforce had spent, what, 30... God knows years trying to get an act through, and it was a group of young evangelicals like Wilberforce was when he began that approached Philippa Stroud at the Centre to say, how can you call yourself Centre for Social Justice? There's slavery in this country. And her reaction was, steady on, chaps. All these things cost money to do inquiries. So they said, yeah, pay for the inquiry, and they paid for the inquiry. And when we then published and were campaigning for it, and then doing this scoping exercise for the bill before we had the joint committee of both houses, they paid for all of it. So it was an intriguing story of the impact of the evangelicals again, where the church shrinks, and yet there's these individuals that have ideas and commitments out of all proportion, just the same as in Birkenhead. That not all, but the vast majority of people who get to and feed hungry kids in the holidays and are doing all sorts of other things to make sure that waste a tiny amount is recycled to people who are hungry, are churches. And it's a huge paradox that the organisation that is on the slides, whatever the denomination, is really the only organisation that produces people who want to do things. The two things that I've witnessed is the loss of trade union influence, the loss of the church's influence. If you're interested in society, what's these two great organisations of making society, and they've not been replaced by anything. And one's witnessed and documented that decline, but in that decline, the one body that can really do something still get people out are the churches.
Not the unions?
No. And not the Labour Party. It's fair enough, isn't it, Andrew? We've written to lots of our new members. I think four wanted to do various activities.
The Labour Party is a moral crusade, or it is nothing. And I guess it's choosing the nothing.
Well, they're there. Quite a lot of them have been there because they want to support Jeremy and protect Jeremy. But they don't want to build this social movement, which he talks about, into an effective political force. I mean, if they really think trying to get rid of me is a great political achievement, it's just utter folly, isn't it? I mean, we've got to actually convince the electorate. But it's very narrowly defined what they see as politics. Whereas I would have thought building a coalition in the town or in towns where there aren't Labour members, but the Labour Party is associated with ensuring that kids go to school who are not hungry, of making sure because we don't have free school dinners during the holidays, that they're actually fed during the holidays and have fun like richer kids, would appeal and build up politics that way. That's after all how the Labour Party 100 years ago would have operated. It wouldn't have thought passing. Resolutions are important to do, but they're not.
What's the situation in your constituency then?
Who knows, but... they did not take us over this time. Whether we're as lucky as next time, I don't know about how we organise. But I mean, it's so destructive to think we're going to spend time on trying to survive when we ought to be campaigning on issues. I mean, it's deeply negative. I mean, Angela Eagle's constituency, as you know, has been overrun by them.
And if they put a fraction of it, as you say, if they put a fraction of the effort into improving society as opposed to talking about improving society.
And I mean, I struck last time when they were getting rid of me and not getting rid of me, getting rid of me and not getting rid of me. And the hatred behind so much of it, which is so appalling. How can good come out when if that sort of bitterness and so on, it's not done because, you know, we think we've got a better argument and all the rest of it. It's just this trot way of organising, which is deeply destructive, I think, both for the people who do it and for the Labour Party more generally, especially if you're thinking longer term. We're actually rewriting the poverty story. The normal framework doesn't hang up anymore. Industry in the post-war period gave people family wages, so you could actually, men were skilled, they were hunters and gatherers, they brought a wage packet home, they had a proper role. And marriage gave them the other side, the women, female side, was not the security of having a family and the role that they most treasure. But in return, they kindly civilised the men as part of the deal for the rest of us. And now we've got a whole group of males who cannot fulfil their historic role. And a lot of women who wouldn't be particularly interested in that role. And we've fallen out of love as a society with nurturing children. And while some are noble beyond belief, it's wonderful. How can you lie in bed, as we have every constituency of the country, expecting little kids to get up while you lie there, get themselves washed, dressed, to school, no breakfast? I mean, it's just unimaginable what's going on. And the amazing thing is they get to school, which is, for lots of them, it's really the only safe place which they know about, but they don't spend that much time there. And I mean, part of Feeding Birkenhead is about, we know parents, we should have a society which allows parents the money to do it and other parents to be, in a sense, shamed into doing it, who have got the money and can't be bothered. But the idea that you've got huge armies of children everywhere in every constituency hungry, and of teachers laying on breakfast clubs and supper clubs as they know that they will go home to cold, empty house. I was struck by one little fellow he'd been adopted, and I said to him, what was the difference for life for you being adopted? And he said it was, go home and it's warm and there's food in the cupboards. Quite chilling, isn't it?
Thank you for listening to Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Robert Colville, CapEx's editor, and I hope I'll see you again next week. If you like this, please subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.